The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for joining me again today, Saturday, August 3rd, 2013, for what's going to be a very interesting show, I'm sure. My guest today is Clement Pulaski, and he will be calling in shortly. Until then, I'd like to take this opportunity to tell you that we have new streaming music at the White Network for the month of August. You just go to the top of the right-hand page and click on something and it comes on. And it's there for listening whenever there is not a program going on. And we always repeat our programs for 24 hours and then we wait for the next program. And in between, you hear this program that Tan Staffel selects every month. It's a real good idea he had to do this. Started with our Christmas program music. But this is Voices of Music for the month of August, performances of Renaissance and Baroque music using original instruments of the time. So it's nice background music, uplifting, probably good for the mind to listen to things like this, I would say. I'm keeping my eye on the callers to see if when Clement will be calling in. I told him to wait for a couple minutes after the hour. And so I'll go on to say a little something about donations, and as soon as he calls, I'll just stop. But donations have been very slow, both at the White Network and at CarolynYeager.net for a couple of months, and I think this is the season. Maybe this happens in the summer. I don't really remember following it, but I would like people to remember, if they do enjoy any of these sites, to send a little something once in a while. I do have two regular donors now. That's it. Who faithfully send something a certain amount every month. I did have three, but one of them has just totally disappeared from view altogether, and I hope he's all right. But I don't want to mention his name in case he wouldn't want me to. Well, here we go. Here's my call. So no more talk about donations. Let me bring up my Skype page and answer this call from Clement. I know I'm so slow about this. I'm not doing it in the right place, really, that I should, and so I'm always looking down at the numbers. Okay, let's see if this call took. Yeah, here he is. Hello, Clement. Yes, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you just fine. It's just great, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I'm going to change over. Oh, look what I did. I'm going to change over to my, let's see. I don't know why I have all this. Oh, heck. I guess I'll just shut it down and worry about it. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Clement Pulaski. And he is, as I said in my mailer, he is kind of new on the scene. Well, he's certainly new to me, and he's not all that old, so I thought that was a pretty good description of you, Clement. And you have a website of your own, which is truesonsofabraham.com, which is really worth reading, even if people think they're not interested in what the subject matter appears to be. You have a very good mind and a good way of writing, too, and grasping things and putting things out clearly. I'm going to say a little more about this in a minute. And you also have been helping with the Daily Stormer, I guess, before it was even put up online. and you've been quite a regular on there. And you also did the first radio program that they put on. It's gotten real good reception from people. So I want to tell you that, you know, you're free to at any time say, well, I'd like to say something about this or that. You don't have to just wait until I, you know, ask you or what I've got laid out here. Because, you know, it can go any way you want to go. I don't know all. I know. Well, I've been reading some of your stuff, and there's one thing I really want to talk about today. But first, you've been on John Friend's program a few times, and I don't want to repeat everything what you said there. And so I don't want to go into a long thing about your life or anything. Just briefly, you know, how did you become aware of the Jewish problem and when?
Well, I guess it was at the end of high school, really, that I first became aware of the race problem. And growing up in a very multicultural area in California, it just started to be very obvious to me all the differences between the blacks and the Hispanics and so forth. And I eventually found, just through internet searches, the old National Alliance website and started listening to William Pierce, his radio broadcasts, and reading the material put out by National Alliance, and that's what ultimately led me to awareness of the Jewish question was through Dr. Pierce's work.
Okay, well, that's true of so many people. Now, how, you know, can you give a general idea of how long ago that was? How long have you been aware of all
sure.
this, maybe getting more and more concerned?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's been about 10 years ago now since I finished high school when I first became aware of these issues, and I guess I've followed the pro-white scene the whole time just by reading blogs and websites and so forth, and I guess maybe I was subconsciously taking Hitler's advice to, a young man in his 20s should spend his time thinking about things and getting his ideology straight before he starts putting himself out there as an authority on different subjects.
I think you're a good example of the success of that, because I do think I was impressed with the idea that, well, you really had your ideas clarified before you started anything. And a lot of people just start out and then they learn and change and grow on the way, you know, and I kind of like your approach.
I've certainly gone through different phases of, while always being pro-white and aware of the Jewish question, sort of different opinions on American conservatism or the Third Reich or these different issues that people debate and religion and so forth. So I guess I am fortunate that I don't have a lot of a long electronic paper trail of stuff I have to explain away at this point. But my personal website, True Sons of Abraham, went up in May, and I started really thinking about doing a project along those lines maybe just in March or April. And just briefly, the website, True Sons of Abraham, was originally intended to be a place where I could attack Christian Zionism and these false heretical notions put forward by John Hagee and pretty much all the other churches to some degree or other at this point. And I guess I had just recently, I guess, become confident enough and familiar enough with church history and the Bible to be able to confidently make arguments along those lines. And I also on my website started writing a little bit about American history and the racial struggle and so forth. And that's what brought me into contact with John Friend and then with Andrew Anglin. And I've been focusing a lot with the Daily Stormer on covering current events from a pro-white Jew-aware perspective.
Right, and I was going to tell people that if they're at their computer to go to truesonsofabraham.com and take a look at it and then click on recent posts and go to that page. It's easy to find. And it has everything you've got on there is very clear and easy to read and fairly large type. It's got a whole list of your blog posts and your articles that people can just click on. And I want to tell them right now that they might want to go there because we're going to be talking at some point in this program, not right away, but on which one is it here? Well, I can't even recognize it because I don't have the full page here. What's the one?
It's the Zeelandsberg conference.
Yeah, I don't even see it now. Why don't I see it? Oh, there it is, right in front of me. The Satanic Pact at Zeelandsberg. And this was written, The Satanic Pact at Zeelandsberg, ladies and gentlemen. Really interesting, and I just, after I read it this morning, I had started to read it on when it was posted at the Daily Stormer, and I didn't finish it. I do that a lot. I start and I say, well, I'm actually in a mode of doing something else, and I happen across something, and I look at it, and I say, well, I'll come back, and then I forget to come back. So, but I'm really taken with this. There's a lot of good things to say here about this and discussion. And so, those of you who want to follow along, it's the Satanic Pact at Zeelandsberg, and you can find it on truesonsofabraham.com/recent posts, or just go there and then click on recent posts. And you wrote this on June 1st, of this year, so it's like 2 months ago. Okay, well, I don't want to get caught up in that, so let's go on to, get a little bit more, familiar with you.
If I could say real quickly about the website,
yes.
It is written from a very Christian perspective, but as you mentioned, I think this is information that's very important to anyone interested in fighting Jewish power, because so many of us have Christian Zionist friends or family, and the biggest impediment for them to coming to the truth of the situation is this Christian Zionism, this heretical doctrine that's taught in the churches. And the point of the website was to create something where you could just send it to your Christian Zionist friend or family member and say, look, read this. Take arguments taken straight from the Bible, directly confronts and deals with all the claims of Christian Zionism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Is that it that you wanted to say?
Right.
Okay. So since we're talking about Christianity here and your involvement in that, that is a very important aspect of your ideology and your thinking and your being, I would say. So how did you become such a strong Christian believer? And whatever you want to explain about that.
Yeah, that could be a long conversation. I'll try to keep it short. Now, I was raised, I am partial Polish descent and part Irish also, and so I was born Catholic, but not really raised Catholic at all. Raised basically atheist. But then as an adult, I became more interested in spirituality. And I guess briefly, the first step was obviously coming to believe in a God of some sort and then looking at the different religions. And I did very seriously consider European paganism, specifically the classical philosophical paganism, and also sort of the Evola-Genon style traditionalism. And I sort of held those beliefs for a time, but eventually came to understand that this modern idea of all religions being right in some way is just ultimately inconsistent. And so I started to look for the one true faith, and reading the Gospels and the New Testament. Just ultimately, it's maybe something you can't explain completely logically, but it just became evident to me that this was the truth. This is the starting point for any ideological discussion or discussion about how we are to live in the world. And in terms of relating it to the struggle, things have just become so twisted today in terms of taking that Christians are natural allies of the Jews, which is, of course, completely unbiblical and goes against the entire church tradition as well. And what really struck me is when I first really understood the idea that as Christians we are supposed to imitate Christ, and that a major part of Christ's earthly ministry was to fight against the Pharisees, and that the Jews of today are the Pharisees, and that it's actually a Christian requirement to fight Jewish power. So it really is, as you mentioned, very much at the center of everything I do and write.
Well, you answered one of my questions there that I've been curious about, and I was going to ask you that you're whether you were Polish, and you're half Irish, half Polish. Both are very Catholic, and you say you were actually brought up you said you're brought up atheist, even though you're Irish and Polish.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was baptized, but then, you know, that was sort of the extent of my Catholic upbringing.
So you come, like me, from a Catholic family that didn't practice it. Did you have relatives, though, who were very, who did? Was it just your immediate family?
Yeah, I did have some relatives who did. You know, it's often the case in America today. I think there's, you know, divides in family where half the people stick to traditional ways and the other half embrace modernism to a greater degree. So that was certainly the case in my family as well. But I really grew up so far away from most of my extended family, so it wasn't much of an influence on me.
Okay. And now, you know, when you were talking, when I read that Seelisberg article today, you were convincing me of the very thing that you said, and brought it to my mind. So that just shows how clearly you put forth what you are, you know, what you are actually thinking and believing. That we need a standard. You know, that's what I got from that really strongly. And, why I was so impressed by it, because, you know, it's so easy to say, well, you know, this religion is this, they say this, and we know all the people that have been involved. And, another thing, I guess maybe I'll bring that up right now. Why not? Well, I didn't really finish what I was saying there. So whether we need one standard to follow or not, okay? And then, you know, what's typical in the modern world today is to say, well, you know, there's truth everywhere, and I think you already even mentioned this, and you know, and then religions are just, you know, things put together by men eventually, and human beings, you know, and people just believe this or that. Because they've been taught to do so and so on. And so you're left, after all that, with questioning everything and not feeling really comfortable by embracing one religion all the way, you know, if you've studied enough and if you're a person like me. I do think that at this point I'm so aware of how we need to follow a consistent and standard for as many of us as possible, or else we're just condemned to be divided and not an effective force. So it's hard. It's hard for people who today to say, well, the Bible, the words that are written in the Bible are what we will follow. However they are, we'll follow these as though it's God's writing. And I'm going on too long here, but I'll just add this. I'm just jumping right in here before I thought I would. That if you don't think that God really writes books and so on and or even inspires certain books or whatever, and when we know that the Catholic Church was involved in writing the books, you know, deciding on the books of the Bible and so on in the beginning, then, you know, how do we put some faith that it's God's word? Or it occurred to me that we don't have to think about it that way. We only have to think that, well, we're going to follow this. And if we all follow it and look for what it's actually saying, then at least we'll have that strength of being all on the same page about something. So after all that, what would you say that would respond to that?
Yeah. Well, there are there are really two questions there. One is, what is the ultimate truth revealed by God? And the other is, what is most useful for our current political struggle as white people?
Right.
And you see both of those questions debated a lot in the movement today. And as you pointed out, having one standard is very useful, because I think we spend a lot of energy just debating with each other and entering into these sort of flame wars on comment sections, mm-hmm. calling each other names and just really not making any progress and not going anywhere. I think the case for or in favor of Christianity from the political perspective has been made very well by Andrew Anglin multiple times, where he said, basically, look, we can't, our race is facing genocide, we can't embark on trying to destroy our spiritual heritage and rooting it out mm-hmm. right in the middle of facing genocide. It just doesn't make any sense. This has been the religion of our ancestors for thousands of years. It was the faith of our people during our periods of greatest achievement. All the successful nationalist movements in the past, even if there were neo-pagans involved in some way. I know that's a contentious issue, how Christian was the Third Reich and so forth. But it was certainly much more Christian than many white nationalists today would like to see in their movement. So, of course, I think that argument is very easy to make, that we do need one standard. And I guess what I would say, and I'm working on some pieces along these lines, is that even if you're not a Christian, a lot of what is being promoted now in the white nationalist movement doesn't have any traditional basis. I mean, there's no traditional European society that accepted sort of absolute total promiscuity, for example, that we have today. There never has been a society like that. It's completely modern and completely Jewish, this attitude, and yet it's still found amongst a lot of our people, even on the within the movement, which is unfortunate. And the other question you brought up, the more profound one and difficult one, which is, how do we know what God really thinks? How do we know what's revelation and what isn't? Canonicity of the Bible and so forth. Those are certainly very difficult questions, and I don't know that there really is a sort of completely valid deductive proof in favor of the Bible. I guess it is a leap of faith at a certain point. I mean, what the church has long argued is that the authenticity of the Bible is proved by, on the one hand, the fact that Old Testament prophecy came true, and on the other hand, that the moral teaching of Christ, there's just an inherent human understanding that this is the highest moral standard, and that God would want the highest moral standard for his revealed doctrine. But, of course, those are very difficult questions, and you can get into very long debates on them, but I hope that sort of answered what you're asking there.
Okay, well, you know, for my sake, so I don't get myself confused here too much, let's leave that for now. I want to get back to that for sure. But let me cover a few of these other questions that I have, and then we'll get back to that. And one that relates to this is abortion for women. What is your position on abortion for women? Would it be that you would deny it altogether? For, you know, any option of that, and would you have a harsh punishment for it?
I am opposed to abortion. I guess for me, it ultimately comes down to where life begins. And in my opinion, I don't see any view, either theological or scientific, other than that life begins at conception. And so it's a human being at conception. There is no other clear dividing line. And so whenever anyone asks about abortion in a specific circumstance, I would say, well, would you feel okay with killing a a big old child at that point under those same circumstances where people say, oh, well, what about rape? Which I know is a very, abortion and rape is a controversial subject, but my general view is, well, if a child was a day old and it was the result of a rape and the mother didn't want it, of course it would have to stay alive. It wouldn't be right to kill it at that point. So, I am very strongly against abortion. And interestingly enough, just recently, I actually posted on Daily Stormer, I believe, an article from Campus Reform about this student at George Mason University who was trying to get people to sign a petition for fourth trimester abortion. That is, a mother should have the right to kill her child as an infant if it's, you know, that's part of a woman's right.
Oh,
to,
yeah, I read that. It's crazy. I don't think they realize what they're saying, do they? I don't think so.
I don't know. I mean, there have been actually more serious arguments in favor of that. I think it was the official Journal of Ethics at either Cambridge or Oxford University. I can't remember which one. Just in the last year or so, some academic actually came out with a serious argument saying, well, an infant is completely helpless. It's just as dependent on its mother as an unborn child is. So, and it's, I guess the other argument is that an infant is not self-aware. So an infant doesn't.
That's awful.
Losing its life
would not. Sorry.
Well, that an infant losing its life would not harm it because it's not aware of what it's losing or something along those lines.
Of course, that's not true.
So,
because infant, you're aware while you're still in the womb. So, and how where that starts, it's impossible to say, and it may be at conception in a way that we will never, know. But once we're born. But that's a very good argument that people would go that far to say, well, now, an infant doesn't know what's going on, so it's okay to kill them, too. That's a very good argument for abolishing abortion altogether. That is a case where you're on a slippery slope and you just keep going further on it.
Yeah. And But
the thing about rape, go ahead. Well, you think what?
I was just going to say, I think it's important to emphasize that this moral degeneracy that we're seeing is just going to get worse and worse. As I've pointed out in some of my posts, we have gay marriage. You are going to have bestiality. That is the next step, and they're pushing for that already. And we do have abortion, and the next step is real post-birth infanticide, and people are pushing for that already. And it's just going to get worse and worse, and it is that slippery slope that you mentioned.
Wow, I realize I agree with you about it's going to get worse, but it's, for me even, it's hard for me to imagine, I can hardly believe that people would be saying these things that you just mentioned, and yet you've shown that they have been. This is where our problem is. We cannot imagine this kind of stuff. But let me go on to, I was talking about rape. Let me just get to the worst of the worst. The rape of a black man on a white woman, and this woman has to bear this child, which she's going to carry in herself for 9 months and, become attached, and the idea, I guess, would be that, well, you have to let it be born and then you can give it up to something, a home or something, orphan as an orphan or whatever. What is that? That doesn't seem to be a good solution. What would you say to that?
I guess I would respond in the same way and answer, or rather ask the question, well, what should be done with a week old mixed race child? Is it okay?
No, but who's going to take care of it? I mean, is the mother? If the mother chose to have a mixed race child, that's one thing. But if the mother did not choose and now had this situation, which could be painful, or difficult all the way through the 9 month period, it would be for me. At this point in my life, I wouldn't have it. But I mean, with what I know and how I feel, and I don't know how much young women maybe see it quite the way I do at my age, but still, it's not just, for some women it would be just that it's a rape and they didn't want it. For someone like me, I don't know how many young women feel that way, but, you know, it's the idea that it's half black, you know, it's sounding really bad here, but you know, that it's, even if it was any other, but others wouldn't be quite as bad as that. Although I wouldn't want any of it. So don't you think you'd have to have some places where the mother had a right to choose, but it would have to be very limited, I guess.
I guess I would still hold to no abortions, period. You know, unless you're prepared to take the life of that child.
Well, what are you going to do with that child?
After it's born.
After it's born. What are you going to do? Who's responsible for it?
It certainly is a difficult situation. I'm not sure, for example, how it was dealt with maybe in America in the past, when mixed race children were certainly not accepted. So I'm sure there were some white women who were raped by blacks during the 19th or early 20th century. I guess I'd want to look and see what the solutions were at that time for the problem. I would say some sort of, in general with children conceived by rape, I would say, some sort of adoption is certainly the best option.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that leads us then to another difficult question. I'm coming out with these difficult ones right in the beginning, it seems like, what do you put first? I'm not trying to be hard on you, Clement. I like your work very much, but what do you put? This comes to my mind, you know. What does your religion or your race come first in your mind? In the case of what we just were talking about, it sounds like religion.
I guess the simple answer is yes. I mean, I don't see them as being in conflict. I don't see having to choose one over the other, but that certainly is an insightful question that, for everybody in the movement, I think either race is their first principle and you alter religion to make it fit those goals, or, religion is your source of first principles and you shape the way your race, lives and thinks in accordance with a divine mandate. And I would certainly fall into the second category there. I do think, obviously the creator of the universe comes first, over any of our, personal or collective goals, and, trying to divine what his will for us is first and foremost and should be at the center of everyone's life. And that's what I believe. And I don't think that there's anything in the Bible or Christian tradition that would harm white advocacy or be disadvantageous for our race. So it's not really necessarily an either or proposition for me, but the short answer would be yes. I think divine revelation comes first, and we are to shape our minds in accordance with that.
Okay, well, I was sure it would have to. It would have to be, but as you're well aware, in the white, pro-white or white loyalist, or, I can use also the white nationalist, a number of people, or just white people, who care about the survival of the race and are aware of the problems, I went on and on so long I missed my point. They put, almost unanimously, people say race has to come first, and then, everybody can have their own religion. That's what I have been saying too. Not that I'm a big spokesman for anything, but, we have to be racial, and then you can follow your religion. It shouldn't conflict with our racial interests. You'd have a hard time. You're so promising and you're such a good person, for us to have, and yet you would have a hard time, bringing a lot of people around to that. point of view. How would you talk to those people?
Well, yeah, let me clarify there. I meant in my personal life, I think, religion comes first for me. But as I mentioned, it doesn't conflict. I mean, everything I do in terms of trying to fight against the Jews and so forth, that is legitimized and sanctioned and blessed by my religious convictions. But in terms of building a movement, I certainly wouldn't say that a political organization needs to be overtly Christian or require any religious convictions. So in terms of building a movement, I don't think that people need to be Christian. I think they need to be white and agree that white interests are worth defending. I would argue from a strategic perspective, I don't think anything in the United States anyway that's anti-Christian will be successful as a political movement. As I mentioned, I wouldn't tell people they need to be Christian to be pro-white, but in terms of my own ideology and how I approach the world and what I believe is the true Christian perspective, the will of God comes first and doesn't conflict with other things, but informs and legitimizes everything else that we think and do.
Okay, so basically then in terms of a movement, then it would be a racial. Everybody would have to agree on race, of course, as to be effective in the movement. But they would not have to agree on religion. That's just, as you're saying, that's how it is for you. And it would be that way for many people. But see, there's a lot, I'm fine with that. There's a lot of, there are some people, I should say, that then would say, well, these people are not 100% loyal because they'll choose the church or they'll choose religion over race if there's a problem or conflict. But you're right that it depends, for most people who are both, there is no conflict there for them.
Yeah, and there really hasn't been, I don't think, historically. If you look at American history, the American people being overwhelmingly Christian and many of them very devout certainly didn't stop us from conquering a continent from Indian natives, and certainly didn't stop us from holding a very strict color line in the American South and so forth. So I don't really see those as being in conflict at all.
Very good. Let's one more thing here. Why do you think there are so few women in the movement, and do you think that this is even a problem? Do you think that this should be a movement of men and women will just come along? Or would you like to see, do you think that, for example, I think the Golden Dawn in Greece, there are a lot of women supporting it. And they might not be they're not in the higher echelon or they're not running it, but there are probably some who have some pretty responsible positions, and there's a lot of women supporting it. And also National Socialist Germany, from the early days, Adolf Hitler had a lot of female support, and it grew. He at times said his female support was stronger and better than his male support. Do you think that this is a problem in white nationalism that so few women are attracted to it? And what else would you say about that?
I would say, well, I guess I could point to a post written by Hunter Wallace. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
Yeah, but you can describe where he's from. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Southern Nationalist from OccidentalDescent.com. And he posted, I guess it was an article from a couple years ago, but he reposted it about women in the white nationalist movement. And I think he just completely hit the nail on the head about why women are not attracted, and I think it's because, to paraphrase what he said and to support what he said, there's a lot of crossover between the white nationalist movement and this men's rights movement, which really bashes women and blames them for a lot of things, which I think is completely, completely wrong and completely irrational to do. So I'd encourage everyone to read that Hunter Wallace piece
Wow.
I think it's called Women in White Nationalism. But I addressed that as well in my the podcast I did for Daily Stormer recently about these men's rights people. The whole men's rights thing is just very odd to me. I understand that feminism, especially this sort of more recent wave of Jewish feminism in the 20th century, mid-20th century, is really destructive and something that's a huge problem for us, in that it divides men and women when we are two halves of the same race. So I agree that feminism is wrong, but it seems that their solution to feminism is to just basically have sex lives that resemble the black male, of just tricking as many women as possible into sleeping with you and being dishonest with them and just sort of by any means necessary, betting them. And that's sort of what I take away from the men's rights movement, which is obviously not going to be appealing to women in general, especially traditionally minded women, who are much more interested in a, more gentlemanly conduct and courtship from men rather than this, this promiscuity that we see today. And, I think you're completely right about, that we need to be more in line with fascist and national socialist attitudes towards women. And this is a great quote from Oswald Mosley, actually, that I have on here. I think I talked about it on John Friend's show. It's just a couple of sentences. I don't know if you mind if I read it again, but I think it just encapsulates perfectly what our attitude towards women should be. And Mosley says, quote, "The future of the race depends on women, and that future is of vital concern to fascism, which is not occupied like the other parties solely by opportunist policies of the present. Fascist government is a trusteeship, not only on behalf of the present generation, but also on behalf of the past and still more of the future. A creed which carries that conscious responsibility must care for the welfare of women," end quote. And I think that's just it, is that we need to have strong traditional families in order to have a strong race. And if you attack women or try to corrupt them by sleeping with them and then leaving them, that's completely counterproductive to our struggle.
Yes. Okay. Well, what about, it seems to me that men who have this anti-woman thing going, or places where it's very popular that it's going on, are also anti-Christian. You know, I'm not saying every case, but it kind of goes together, that they tend to be the atheists and the Christian bashers who do this the most. Do you notice that or not?
Yeah, I do. And the other thing, which is at first sort of strange, but maybe on a closer look not so strange, is that these men's rights guys seem to be okay with homosexuality. And I know that people like Jack Donovan seem to be popular with the men's rights and homosexual movements. And I think it's just maybe that one set of sexually permissive ethics sort of justifies another. That is, you can't really be promiscuity between men and women and then still take a hard line on homosexuality, I guess, because you want your own sexual freedom, so that's why you're not going to make a big deal about someone else's sexual practices. But yeah, I think in general they are just very much opposed to any sort of sexual ethics. I don't know if their distaste for Christianity is what inspired their free sexual ethics, or if it was the other way around, that they have these sexual desires and rather than trying to get them into line, they just bash ideologies that tell them to have more self-control. But there certainly is a connection there.
Well, that's very good. And you know, I was thinking how the freedom it's kind of a fraud, you know, that I was so big on freedom all my life. I thought that was the best word in the entire vocabulary, along with truth. But, you know, I thought freedom was just so great. And we're sold on freedom all the time. And we're told that democracy makes us free. And, you know, we want to live in free countries and all this stuff, and in the end, you know, the truth is there's nothing free. Nothing is free. And this freedom has had a terrible cost, that when you want to be free all the time and not be tied down and not this, not that, you know, you pay a big price for it. So it's like the whole system that we've been under for so long. And basically, I would say, since World War II, but really taking hold in the 60s and being promoted, you know, big time since then, is where we've gone wrong. And we need to, what do you say about, oh, people say, well, we can't go back. You don't go back. We don't want to go back. That's just conservatism. We want to go forward into revolution. This just occurred to me now. What would you say about this difference between this putting down conservatism and building up that we can have some kind of a revolution that's going to work in our interests?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of legitimate criticism of the conservative movement and the way that conservatives deal with things, and I think it boils down to conservatives being on the defensive instead of the offensive, which is why, at least part of why, they keep on losing on every issue all the time. And so I would, you know, I don't talk about myself being a conservative too much, just because it does have those negative connotations. And I think conservatism sometimes looks just too much at the superficial aspects of previous eras and not really at the essence of them. And of course, one of the arguments I've made is that the fascist and national socialist movements weren't in conflict with traditional Americanism. They were just struggles taking place under different circumstances. And we have to take into account, as right-wing revolutionaries, different problems that we have and come up with different solutions and create societies that maybe don't look exactly like European societies or American society in the past, but that work towards the same ultimate goals, but not so much being exactly like superficially like previous eras. And I think that's why a national socialism is so important and why the Third Reich was so successful, is because it completely dealt with all the problems of modernism. It dealt with the Industrial Revolution. It dealt with advances in science and technology, mass media, all these advancements that have been very corrosive when in the hands of the Jews. It dealt with those problems. It completely integrated all those advancements into a virtuous traditional European society. And I think that really needs to be the model.
Yes. All right. Now I have this. We've got less than 15 minutes before we 10 minutes before we go to our break. Now I'll go into this now. I have this simple idea that if we just stop participating in Jewish culture, even if it was, you know, not total right away, because everything is Jewish culture around us, but the most obvious aspects of it, that would be the most effective thing that we could do, because all this talk about building things when the enemy is so strong seems to be not the most effective. And yet boycotting or not participating in Jewish culture is, you can't get white people to do it. I think more attention should be put on this, and you are certainly a person with your views that would go along with that. Now, if you just started with movies and television, you know, you would make a huge impact if enough people stopped doing it. And then, you know, there's more than that, but people just don't want to be inconvenienced in the least little bit, and even people who think they're in the white nationalist movement.
Yeah, well, I think on a personal level, breaking away from Jewish film and television is really sort of a bare minimum for what we need to do if we're serious about this. And I do think that British control of entertainment and news media is their single greatest tool that they use to corrupt us. And I think it's really because of mass media and the way that the Jews got into Hollywood and dominated it from the very beginning that they've had such success in the United States in the 20th century. And so absolutely building alternative medias and sort of disengaging from Jewish Hollywood is absolutely essential. That would maybe lead the conversation more towards the Daily Stormer and what we're trying to do, and of course what you're doing with the White Network of building alternative media, because it's true that a lot of people, they're just so addicted to film and television that they can't stop giving money to Jewish Hollywood. They just, you know, there are all these, you know, even mainstream conservative Christians should be aware of how evil Hollywood is, even if they don't understand it as a Jewish problem. And yet there are all these Christian middle American families who still on Saturday night take the whole family down to the multiplex and spend $60-$70
right
watching the latest anti-white, yeah, anti-American, anti-Christian filth coming out of Hollywood. And people are just so addicted to it. And they, if you read Christian movie review websites, they'll sometimes say, oh, this movie was good except it had this one scene that was really bad, or you know, it was good except for this one aspect of the plot, but that's not enough for them to stop paying to go see it, which is unfortunate. And it is it's a very seductive form of entertainment. It just
When you really wake up and realize things, I think it makes you sick. I don't, you know, the seduction of it only comes along as you have not really clearly come to a decision in yourself. That's what I think. And then we have, now you and I have both talked about countercurrents.com. And I mentioned on my Monday show that how they do so many movie reviews. Well, this is well known for people who know that site. And they have, they've always done that. And they're just, you know, they don't go along. They think that they are presenting, you know, alternative right wing white material, you know, for people. And it's filled with all these reviews of movies in which they're supposedly are, you know, enlightening us about white archetypes or whatever, you know, whatever's going on in these movies, but it encourages, excuse me, people to go to the movies. And it doesn't make any sense. So we have people who just don't get it. They just don't get it. They don't want to get it. And I think it needs to be dealt with more strongly than just once in a while telling them they shouldn't go there. We really should. Thing there is to continue to absorb a Jewish culture.
Yeah, and well, I think the problem for a lot of people is that they need, maybe not people in the movement, but a lot of people who aren't really that interested in politics, is that they need some sort of entertainment in their lives. They're going to either watch the football game or go to the movies or something, and I think it's really up to us to create an alternative media. I mean, most pro-white media, I think because we're just such a small resource-strapped movement, that you know, our media focuses just on very directly dealing with the issues, doing analysis of news and politics and history and so forth. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think if we're going to be successful, we need our own alternative entertainment media, and even you know, children's media and so forth, because people are just going to consume something, and we need to be able to give them something that's not so poisonous. And I really am hopeful in development in this area, just because video production technology is becoming so much cheaper, and you're really able to make very impressive looking things on a very small budget compared to, say, in the 1950s or 60s, when you needed thousands, if not millions, of dollars to produce something that looked professional. And I do think that's an area that we need to focus on.
Well, that's great, because, you know, you're young, And Andre is young, and so, you know, and the more young people who are really clear, the ones that you two are the best that I've seen that are really clear and committed about what needs to be done. You know, you are young enough to start building something like this. Because you're right that people want entertainment, but we can't compete with what the Jews have but you know, when you think about, I was thinking of the Third Reich. They had their own film. They had a big, of course, they were a whole nation. They had a lot of money too, but they had an excellent film, they even were starting television, but they were able to do that and provide entertainment for their people. And they didn't hedge on that. They didn't say, like I'm saying, well, you don't need entertainment. Think about things instead. Read books. But, you know, they provided a lot of entertainment for the people and certainly wouldn't have been against anything that was against their interests. So we have to have that positive attitude. I'm glad you do. Go ahead.
And just to mention briefly again the film from the Third Reich, I was really impressed when I saw the Munchausen film, which I guess is sort of the star centerpiece production of the National Socialist movie industry. And it's a beautiful film, great entertainment, and it's not, you know, it's not propagandistic. It's not, you know, a political film. It obviously subtly reinforces the ideology of the Third Reich, but it's also just great entertainment and something that people to this day still enjoy, even if they're not sympathetic to national socialism.
Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be back with Clement Pulaski after this 5-minute break.
Oh,
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and my guest is Clement Pulaski. We've been having what I think is a great conversation, and we'll continue it now. He is the owner of the True Sons of Abraham, .com website, and also is a big part of the DailyStormer.com website. And so, Clement, would you like to say anything more about the Daily Stormer as an alternative or white media source before we move on to something else?
Sure. I guess I've explained briefly elsewhere already that the goal, as I'm sure most of your listeners know already, the goal of the Daily Stormer was to be basically a pro-white, feudal-ware version of Alex Jones InfoWars website. That is, we cover a wide range of news, not just the narrow spectrum of news directly related to racial issues, just to give a sort of full view of important news of the world. And we also provide a lot of commentary that focuses on the Jewish question and white survival and so forth. And we're just really trying to promote a successful message for a mass movement, and that's what Englund has really focused on in a lot of his writing and guest appearances elsewhere, is we just need to find a message that is successful that will get people to support our cause. And I do think that the Daily Stormer will could possibly do a lot to further that goal.
Okay, so do you have an idea what that successful message is? That, you know, has it been found, or you're saying it that we have to find it?
Well, I think I think we're definitely getting closer. I think Englund and I, you know, the reason that we're working together so well on the site is that we're really on the same page in a lot of these things. Where we understand that we need to stop bickering amongst ourselves. And I think that's the big reason why the movement hasn't really moved or gone anywhere, is because we're still just fighting amongst each other, or amongst ourselves, and it's very hard to draw more people in when we can't agree on practically anything. And I know one of the issues I've focused on a lot is how exactly to present Hitler and the Third Reich, and how to deal with that question. Because I think the two solutions from the pro-white movement are either to completely disparage Hitler and say that's not at all what we're doing, that's not what we're about, we shouldn't talk about Hitler, we shouldn't talk about the Holocaust or anything, just ignore it, pretend it's not there. And I think that's obviously a problematic approach, just to leave the Holocaust myth and the myth about the Third Reich intact in the minds of people. And then the other solution has been to be very overtly pro-National Socialist and to use swastikas and uniforms and so forth, which, you know, I don't want to, you know, criticize too much all the brave people in the United States who have done those sorts of things, but I know Englund has mentioned that he would not use the word fascism or the swastika in promoting a mass movement, but you need to find a fine line there on how to break the myth of the Third Reich at the same time to not say that we are a National Socialist movement exclusive of anything American history, and American history and American tradition is all wrong. So I guess that is, I don't want to ramble too much here, but that's certainly part of forming a coherent message that will be accepted by a large number of Americans. As we mentioned, the religious issue is another one, where we're not going to say you have to be Christian, but we're not going to really allow Christian bashing on Daily Stormer either, as that really doesn't get us anywhere and just leads to a lot of bickering amongst ourselves. Sexual morality, obviously a big thing I focused on. Englund also has has long opposed these sort of homosexual white nationalist types. And I guess that would give a good idea of some key issues where there's been a lot of disagreement where we need
to... Do you think there should be less critical approach to other people in the movement who, if you think that, but what if you think that they're not, what if you think that their message is harmful or dishonest or even disinfo? You think that and this would be going on, Okay, and this brings in also the large number of disinfo that would be going on, trolls and all that kind of thing. There's no way it would not be going on, and people who are setting themselves up as leaders for the very purpose of destroying the movement, a real movement, which has to be there. And so you end up, but if you're criticizing people or if you're suspicious of people, but you're not able to actually show proof or whatever, this all is something that is not easy to say, well, let's stop bickering and let's just, find agreement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I agree. I guess to give some sort of specific answers, in my recent post against the sodomite right, where I talked about countercurrents, my suggestion is that we just completely ostracize them and don't read their websites, don't buy their books, don't appear on their shows. The really corrosive thing about countercurrents is that not only do they promote this very insidious position, but so many people go along with it, or even if they say they don't agree with it, they'll still be friends with the folks at Countercurrent, still collaborate with them, and that's the type of thing that really needs to stop, and I hope that we're able to convince people in the movement that we're going backwards, we're not making any progress towards coming up with a successful ideology by allowing this type of thing. I mean, I don't think 10 years ago there was really much talk about, is homosexuality okay? Can you be pro-white and homosexual at the same time? I just don't remember seeing any of that. And it really seems like we're, rather than making progress, we're going backwards in that area.
Okay, thanks. That will take us right into this Seelisberg essay or article that you wrote. But before that, let me just mention that I just saw something that Ellen DeGeneres, the lesbian who is so popular on TV, and the Miss America almost, Little Miss America, returns to, is going to host the Oscars, and the new Academy president approved the idea immediately. And this is just another example of how this has all happened so fast. It was only a few years ago that I used to watch the TV while I was walking on the treadmill and so on at this fitness place. And I would, around the time I was there, I'd see her show, and it was still a shocking thing when she could you could tell, but then she came out and it was all, oh yeah, she's gay. And now, I mean, it, just a few years' time is just mainstream. And this is, but how many people are going to pay attention to who's been what's been nominated and who the Oscars are and want to watch it and talk about how she performed and so on? this is the kind of thing we don't need to be, we don't need to be up on all this stuff. People say, and they might even believe that, well, I need to know what's going on. I want to hear what they're saying. I want to know, we don't need to know all that stuff. We could just ignore it. And so I think, and I was going to also say that I think we are, and especially Europeans, but us too here in the United States, are kind of addicted to the entertainment aspect of politics. So, our need for entertainment goes beyond what's considered entertainment and even into every area where we want it, you know, we look for the entertainment. And okay, I'll just say this. I know that a site like Daily Stormer, needs to be appealing and, needs to be attractive and attract people and so on. And then though, you do run the risk of, people going there just for entertainment and wanting to just look at the most entertaining parts of it. But I guess there's no way around that, is there?
Yeah, I mean, we want it to be popular, but it's very uncompromising in its vocal criticism of the Jews and focus on racial issues. So I don't think anyone could read the website without taking in some of that message.
Well, right. They take in the message. Yeah, they like that message, but they want it to be, you know, in a kind of an entertainment venue. Which isn't all, but I guess, you know, we're looking at all the people, and you have to give them that. In fact, in the Third Reich, which I know you don't want to, there's a call here, it's undisclosed. I'm not going to take this call. Listeners, you can call, I was going to announce that, 830-443-4911, but no undisclosed phone numbers, please. Remember what I was going to say. So let's just go on to, the Satanic Pact at Seelisburg, which is about, this meeting that took place, a pretty important one between the Christian and Jewish, leaders, church leaders. And, I'll go to it, but why don't you tell us, give us an introduction to that. A meeting.
Sure. So this was in Seelisburg, Switzerland in 1947, and it was held by the International Council on Christians and Jews, an organization that claimed to support Christian-Jewish dialogue. And as I point out, there never really is any dialogue. If the Jews are involved and are promoting an organization, it's because it's advancing their position and weakening ours. And that's exactly what happened here, and it was just a couple years after World War II had ended, and already they were trying to guilt white Christians into removing or changing their religion to suit the Jews and tying traditional Christianity into the Third Reich and saying that somehow Christianity was responsible for the supposed suffering of the Jews during World War II, and that Christianity has to change so in order to prevent a second Hitler from coming to power. And so they attached several of the key ideas in Christianity and came up with what's known as the 10 points of Seelisburg, basically distortions of biblical truth and church history formulated in such a way to promote the Jews and try to convince Christians that they have a religious duty to support Jewish causes.
Yes, and you know, and the Christians go right along with this. And you wrote that you talked about the biology of the Jew. You said, Christians should hate Judaism as we hate Islam or pagan idolatry. That's later. Okay. You say that, I'm confusing myself here, that our Christian doctrine is not based on racial, I may have that further on down. It's not based on race, but on the scriptures. And we may have, you may have covered that in the first hour. But it was that you can become a Jew. The bottom line is that if you're a Jew, you can become a Christian. And there are a lot of people who don't go along with that. So, you know, and I mentioned here Brother Nathaniel Kapner. Do you think that it's fine? I never had such a problem with him. But do you think that it's fine that Nathaniel Kapner was... can be a Christian, and that what do you think of him anyway?
Nathaniel Kapner, I guess his videos always, in his videos, he always struck me as being sort of an odd individual. I know Anglin has posted some video footage of him dancing around in a very bizarre fashion in public while wearing his religious garb. And I guess it's unclear whether he actually ever lived in a Russian Orthodox monastery or not. But that aside, I do think that that Christianity is for everyone, but it doesn't change your biology. And for example, you know, blacks can become Christian, but that doesn't change their biology. That doesn't make them. That doesn't raise their IQ. It doesn't automatically take away their violent tendencies or anything like that. And it's the same with the Jews, where you know I would encourage Jews to convert, but I would not welcome them into our movement after they do, because they are a separate group. If you look at church history, there have been huge problems with phony conversions by the Jews, where they convert and then just try to subvert the church right afterwards. That's certainly something we should be aware of, and I would not, you know, I encourage the Jews to accept Christ, but that doesn't make them white. It doesn't mean that they are part of our movement, and they should still be kept at an arm's distance. And really, if they were serious about Christianity, they would be trying to evangelize their own people. And I guess there are some Jewish converts who do that, but most of the Jewish converts to Christianity that I've seen are very pro-Zionist and really just seem to be infiltrating the church to further the Zionist cause.
Right.
And so the point I was making...
Okay, go ahead.
Well, the point I was making in the Zuisberg article was that the church, you know, there are biological studies in sociology or other sciences, I should say there are biological or sociological studies and theories about race, and that the church shouldn't deem those good or bad, that the church should deal with theological issues, and that, you know, the National Socialists weren't sinful for thinking that Jews have different biology. That doesn't go against any Christian teaching. So that was sort of the point I was trying to make there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you and so again, you separate the movement from religious belief, in a sense. You know, for if people, it can fit together for some people, but if it doesn't, I mean, you don't, you have one attitude as a Christian toward Jews who are welcome to become Christians, you say, but that doesn't mean that they're welcome in the white racialist movement.
Right, exactly. And a lot of Christians today have this idea that opposing Jews theologically is somehow racist or racialist, which doesn't make any sense because, of course, there are legitimate criticisms of the Jews from a biological perspective, but if you're talking
right,
just
and
about
that's what the Jews were trying to put across there, and the Christians in this conference thing here, and the Christians were accepting it. That to feel to be opposed to racial mixture with the Jews was terrible and wrong, and Christians should never do it. Well, we've got this, I want to go on with this, but we've got a caller on the line, and I think I know who he is, but caller, would you identify yourself, please?
This is Russell calling. How are you this afternoon?
Well, we would like to know what your question is, Russell.
Well, I was interested because you were talking about Ellen DeGeneres.
Okay, you know what? It's just like Mike Piper last time. I don't want to get off on something that's not really the point of what we're talking. She was just an example of what we shouldn't be paying attention to. So do you have anything to really address the guest Clement with about his website or his writing?
Yes, I wanted to say that, now I'm sure both of you are probably familiar with the term GLBT.
Of course.
Gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. Now, that term has been updated now to LGBT, which means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. It's no longer correct within that movement to say GLBT. You have to say
okay,
LGBT.
Well, you hurry up with the question, Russ, so that he can answer something.
Oh, okay. I would like to ask your guest, and then, oh, by the way, they've added a Q on the end to it, which means it stands for questioning.
Yeah,
lesbian, gay, bisexual,
yeah,
transgender, yeah. And questioning. Because in the schools, they want to have...
Russ, you are not the guest on this. I hate to be so rude to you, but, you know, you're not the person that people have tuned into this program to listen to. So we don't want to hear what you think. We want to hear what you want to hear from Clement, okay?
Clement, what do you think about that?
About the changing nomenclature for sexual deviance, just, I guess, quickly say that it sort of highlights really the insanity of these people and that they're constantly self-censoring themselves and seeking for more subtle levels of bias and bigotry in their own minds and in their own behavior. So they're never satisfied. They're always going to keep on looking for another way that they are subconsciously repressing or oppressing some minority, and there's really just no end to it. And I think that's what's obvious by this just recent change to make sure to put the gays after the lesbians, because you don't want to put the men in front of the women in the abbreviation for the sexual deviance.
And that was a nice touch, Ed. It was a nice touch adding the Q on the end, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Russ. You got your answer. A good answer. Thanks for your call, Russ. So,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, when we, going back to this article of yours, another touchy part of the Christian thing for a lot of people, and I found that you come right out and say Jesus was a Jew. You know, I mean, because that's scripturally, as you interpret scripture, that is the fact, and you don't try to avoid it. But, you know, a lot of people really hate that and don't want to accept that idea.
Maybe to clarify, I mean, I don't know if I've ever, you know, said Jesus is a Jew. In the Sealsburg, I note that I guess really what I'm saying is that the Pharisees in the New Testament and the apostles and Jesus, they are all of the same nation. And the people who call themselves Jews today are at least partially genetically descended from the Pharisees and their followers who killed Christ and rejected God's covenant. Of course, they've mixed with a lot of other people, including in the Central Asian Khazars, most likely. But at any rate, they are the spiritual descendants of the Pharisees. So I do affirm that understanding of mm-hmm. Christ's ethnicity and the ethnicity of the Pharisees.
And bringing up the subject of Christian identity, let me first say you are very biblical in your understanding. You follow the Bible and you quote Bible verses to back up what you're saying. And your position is that that's what should be followed. That's what makes the difference. And actually, you're just saying that that's what a Christian must do. But you say you're not Christian identity, and I understand now why you're not, because of what I just brought up. And they see it altogether differently. And you say, I know you said that you don't accept it that way. You don't see it that way. You don't interpret it that way. And so, even though you're totally, so would you say that you're a follower of Luther, of who the first Protestant teachings? What would you, you know?
In terms of my own, religious identity, the term evangelical has such negative connotations nowadays, but I guess that's closer I'm closer to that in a lot of ways, and that I want to try to live according to the Bible and the ancient church, the primitive church. And so in my research, I focus not just on the Bible, but on the early church fathers. And I certainly, when it comes to the reformers, I very much support their criticism of the Roman church. I think that was very legitimate criticism. And I'm certainly, generally speaking, a Protestant. I'm not part of a specific church like the Presbyterian or Lutheran church or any of those. So I guess just a non-denominational Protestant Christian.
Okay, so when you did you ever belong to a church? Did you start? Were you in a church? But you now are. What do you find? Why do you not want to belong to a church? I could never belong to a church either.
Well, the real problem for me, and this was a difficult thing to come to grips to in our current society, is just that the churches are so corrupted, and when you take communion with your fellow Christians, you're supposed to be really of one mind and one spirit, and I can't really take communion with people who think that the Jews are God's special people and we need to bless them and help them, and who think that our race being destroyed would be a great benefit for mankind. I mean, those are just such evil opinions that they have. So it's, you know, the churches are so corrupted today that I wouldn't really want to belong to any established church. You know, if there were a church in the Anglican Communion that taught what I believe the Bible teaches about the Jews, I would certainly participate in that. I guess that's of the branch of Protestantism. I'm maybe closer to Anglicanism in a lot of ways.
Okay, because you're right. I mean, there are no churches, no Christian churches that teach the truth about the Jew and will stand the way they used to about the Jews, which is this whole conference that you wrote about reveals this, how the Christians, the church agreed not to have any kind of a negative attitude toward the Jews whatsoever. They even in point six, it says avoid, they're point six of this, you go through all the points. Avoid using the word Jews in the exclusive sense of the enemies of Jesus and the words the enemies of Jesus to designate the whole Jewish people. That's what the Christian church has to stop doing now, you know. Right.
Right. And that's, as I point out, that's completely biblical. The New Testament writers like Paul, they already refer to the Jews as the murderers of Christ and the apostles and the prophets before them. So this is directly contradicting what's right there in the New Testament. And the Christian Bible and the Christian tradition is just so clear on the Jewish issue. It's just sort of infuriating to have to debate Christians on this topic sometimes. I was debating a Calvinist on an internet forum, and I quoted Calvin talking about the Jews, about how they're a horrible, reprobate people who get everything they deserve, basically. And I quoted this, and he said, "Oh, well, that's Nazi garbage, and you're going to go to hell for believing this about the Jews." So you had a Calvinist telling me that I'm going to hell because I agree with Calvin. And that's just the point we're at today, with all of the churches. The same with the Catholic and even the Orthodox Church, which some people try to promote as a bastion against Jewish power. But if you try to talk to Orthodox about what John Chrysostom said about the Jews, or the fact that they're child saints in the Orthodox tradition that were said to have been killed by the Jews during their Passover rituals. This is something that the church used to affirm, and they'll just be silent on it, or they'll pretend that it doesn't exist, or they'll say, "Oh, you just need to be more loving and person," you know, something, some nonsense like that. So all the churches have this problem where they've completely turned their back on their own traditions, and you try to bring it up to them, and they're so deaf and stubborn. I've still tried to produce pretty clear, logical arguments in favor of the anti-Jewish position.
Well, I noticed that. And but do you think that someone could use the Bible and words and verses and phrases in the Bible to counteract what you are saying, what you say it means?
Well, they certainly try, but they quote very selectively, and they distort what the passages are supposed to mean. I have a post I'm working on now about John Hagee to give a specific example of this. It says in the book of Genesis, when God is speaking to Abraham and forming his covenant with him, he says to Abraham that the whole world will be blessed by your seed. And John Hagee tries to say that if you look at all the great Jewish entertainers, this is proof that the world is blessed by Abraham's seed. And but this is, there's also in the New Testament a passage where this verse from Genesis is directly quoted, and it says very clearly in the Bible that when God told Abraham the whole world would be blessed by his seed, God was talking about Christ. Christ is Abraham's seed, and that's why the whole world is blessed by Abraham's seed. And so it's just completely obvious from the New Testament how we're supposed to interpret this passage from Genesis, and yet Hagee says, you know, because we have Larry King and Ann Landers and Peter Sellers and all these Jewish entertainers, that's how the Jews are a great blessing for the world.
Brother.
And so it's just, the arguments are so bad, it almost feels kind of strange to even have to argue against them, because you're really just holding someone's hand reading through the New Testament. Okay, this is what it says. The Christian Zionist message is completely wrong, completely unbiblical, completely unhistorical, and, you know, I hope it's getting to people, but some people are just so brainwashed by the Jews that it's, you know, in one of my posts I've said that Christian Zionism is a form of idolatry, which I think is correct. I mean, they really do think that the Jews are sort of this magical people, and that if you give in to all of their political demands, that you'll get divine blessing in return. And it's just completely backwards and hard to even call it Christianity at that point.
Yes, well, I think you're doing a great job of correcting that and setting the record straight about a lot of things. You know, flew past over Christian identity, but how do you have a strong aversion to Christian identity, or you just don't agree with it, or how do you view it?
You know, I've never found it remotely appealing or plausible. I guess it's basically my position, especially when it comes to the sort of specific ideas. And I know there's no one set of Christian identity dogmatic beliefs that you can point to, but what is generally considered to be Christian identity includes belief in the dual seed line doctrine, and this idea that only white people can be saved, or that all the white nations are the lost tribes of Israel. I guess, first of all, on the topic of the dual seed line, I don't see any biblical support for this doctrine. There's no historical support for it. No one in the early church ever believed this. As far as I know, there's some mention in the Talmud and maybe some Gnostic heretical writings that talk about the dual seed line theory, but it's certainly not a traditional Christian belief and never really has been. And if you read the New Testament, I think it's quite clear that the distinction is there between Jew and Gentile, between the Israelites of the flesh and the nations of the world who are not Israelites. And it's quite clear that the apostles are supposed to bring in the nations of the world to preach the gospel to all people, even those, and specifically those who are not fleshly Israel. And if you look at the epistles in the New Testament written to churches in Greece or Rome, it's quite obvious that the apostles did not consider the Greeks or Romans to be Israelites and descendants from the lost tribes. And so as I mentioned, it's just, to me, it's never made any sense historically or theologically.
Okay, well, what about the universality of Christ? I think I read that you said that the Christian message is universal. And how do you prevent that from making everybody equal, or
I guess people have really tried to pin the blame for egalitarianism on Christianity. I think that's unfair. It's not really supported historically. There were certainly societies with very strong hierarchies, and I would argue that had very strong hierarchies that were highly Christian, and I would argue that the opposite is really true, that this move towards egalitarianism always accompanies an apostasy from the Christian faith, and we see that in the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution or the Cultural Revolutions in the United States in the 60s, this push for racial egalitarianism and rejection of Christianity always go hand in hand.
Yeah. That's right. I wouldn't argue against that. At the end of this article, you write, the sufferings of the Jews will end only when they accept Jesus Christ, who is the only spiritual health and the only salvation. I understand you have to put this in context of the whole article, but, it's not the Jews who are suffering now. It's us who are suffering. So why would we say that, why would we tell that to the Jews? This was your writing, I believe, not from the meeting.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe I could have been clearer. In sufferings of the Jews and the Christian culture in general is referring to the Jews being kicked out of different countries being restricted legally or economically. And the point I was making was it's because of their wicked religion that Christians have to deal with them in that way. And it's not something that we should change. We aren't the ones who have to change. They're the ones who have to change, I guess.
It's probably, there's nothing wrong with having this position and saying, well, now, when you can accept Jesus Christ, then we can accept you and get out of your bad religion. Because they would ever actually do that. You think that that's a possibility at all? I guess you'd have to say it was a possibility.
Well, it's a possibility for individuals, certainly. Whether or not you think Jews can convert, I don't see how that would really change how we should deal with the Jews. I mean, we need to view them as an enemy, and Jews who convert should not be allowed to have positions of power or full rights in our societies. I think that's been clearly shown by all the conversion controversies in Spain and Italy in the past. I guess the other thing I was getting at with the sufferings of the Jews is, maybe once again I should have made this more clear, but by sufferings we shouldn't just look at earthly inconveniences, but rather spiritual suffering, that is sin, and any sort of measures on the political in the political sphere aren't really going to be fully satisfying or really end the worry or suffering for any people, I guess is what I was also getting at there, is that salvation in Christ is a step above, transcends any other earthly concerns. And so if they're really interested in an end to their suffering, they shouldn't be so fixated on purely earthly inconveniences that they perceive, but should be rather focused on the fact that they've rejected God, they've rejected their own Messiah, and that's a much bigger problem for them than any earthly inconveniences or legal restrictions that they might face.
Exactly. Okay, I was looking for another story that I had here, but I don't see it. I don't know. Can't find it. So, but this one is very interesting. If you'd like, if we make a few comments about this and then, you know, relate it to, the work at the Daily Stormer and so on. That is this information that's come out in Germany that Helmut Kohl, who was the chancellor in the 80s, it has been revealed by some release of, you know, classified information in Great Britain about his that he had a plan that he that he was talking to the female prime minister there at that time. Can't even see her name here. You know, that famous one.
Thatcher.
Thatcher, thank you. Yeah, Prime Minister Thatcher, that he was, that he had this plan. He wanted to have the number of Turks living in Germany. He wanted to reduce the number by half. And he had, I had a, the previous article, which, that he gave some reasons for that. It's pretty interesting. But it never got done, and some of the reasons were that it was, well, events got in the way. Certain events started happening, and, you know, so it kind of got lost. But that was the intention. He thought way back then, it was in 1982, that, was it 82, that he had decided that these Turks were not good for Germany. And that some of the other immigrants were, you know, assimilated better, but the Turks didn't. And he thought that, you know, he had to get rid of them. And he was going to do it, but it didn't get done. And now that's interesting to where we are now, to where they're building monuments to the Turks and apologizing to them for everything that, you know, acting like they're not totally welcome and so on. Do you want to comment on that at all?
Sure. There have been a few other similar stories that have come up in the last few years showing that many of the political leaders in the Western world in the 60s and 70s and 80s, on a certain level, they understood how bad all this multiculturalism and immigration was going to be for us. Margaret Thatcher recently passed away, and I guess there were some documents revealed that she had a negative view of immigrants as well. Of course, there are the famous tapes where Richard Nixon shows that he's aware of the Jewish question and so forth.
Yeah.
And I think it maybe just highlights how spineless these political leaders are and how maybe they really weren't the ones in charge to begin with if they indeed held these personal views. And these are the leaders of some of the major states in the world, and yet even they are afraid to speak out about these issues when they're at the height of their power. And it's something that they have to whisper about in private. And I think it's very telling about how corrupt and spineless and really lacking in power these figurehead leaders are.
Right. You know, and now it's that it wasn't so... Like you just said, it was something that people felt and understood at the time. And it says in this another article that that the German people would have been more amenable to doing that. They've been more in agreement with it then than they are now, because we've been further indoctrinated into thinking that any kind of a racist thought is you know, distinguishing between different peoples and different races is terrible, or you shouldn't mind having people from all over in your country and becoming citizens. And, you know, so the difference is also in the German people from then to now. And it's a downward spiral. And it says here that this Mehmet Kilic, who's of Turkish descent and member of the Green Party, will naturally... He says, while the exposure of Helmut Kohl's way of thinking may be a novelty, it is a mindset that has been espoused by the CDU and its Bavarian sister party for decades. Well, that's just a political statement. I thought I had a better one than that. Here it is. They say, this social democrat says about it, this school of thought was influenced by the idea that immigrants and refugees in Germany were nothing more than a liability. But he says, these days, immigration is seen as an opportunity, partly due to Germany's shortage of skilled workers. So that brings us back around to the lack of a birth rate, and this just increases the idea that we will have foreigners in our countries to do the work because we're not producing our own progeny.
Yeah, I guess I would add that although certainly back in the 80s, Europeans would have been more supportive of a move to reduce immigration or expel immigrants, I think that even today, a lot of people, both in Europe and the United States, would be supportive of this if the head of state and the media were behind this idea of removing foreigners. You go to Europe, and I've traveled through a few different European countries, and you talk to people, and the same people will tell you on the one hand, for example, in Britain, oh, the BNP is evil, but then they'll next say, oh, these immigrants are such a problem, and I need to find a place to move away so I don't have to deal with them. So I think even people who think of themselves as politically correct are still aware of the negative impacts of immigration. And of course, things are worse today in our culture than they were in the 80s, but I think even today, it's all this anti-racism and political correctness, it's very much a top-down, imposed ideology that people would get away from very quickly if the official propaganda message were changed.
Well, I think you hit the thing right on the head there that, and Tan Stoffel has talked about this too, that, you know, people move away, you know, people naturally don't want to live with people who are that different from themselves. They move and they locate amongst themselves, and they know this, but at the same time, they don't want to think they do it for racist reasons because of this brainwashing that it's so bad. And this again goes back to Adolf Hitler and how they associate that with killing people who are different from yourself and treating them badly. And, you know, the whole thing is just needs so much clarification needs to be done so that people can think about this and not feel guilty. Because when you said that they move away, but then they say that these parties like the BNP is evil because it comes right out and says we don't, you know, we'd like to get these people out of our country. But it says in 1982, 1.5 million Turks were living in Germany by 1982. They started coming in 1973. Well, they started coming in the 60s, but they weren't so many. But they started allowing them to bring their women and children in, the workers. You know, before they started out coming just as male workers, and then they allowed them to bring their families in. And then it just keeps growing and growing. Okay, Don Gates says he's trying to call, but all I got was a post number. Try to call again, Don. There was 1.5 million, but then at the same time, 1.8 million people were unemployed after they had brought all these Turks in. And German citizens were beginning to see the immigrants as burdens on the social welfare system and competitors for jobs. And that's when this Kohl, who was chancellor, wanted to start this thing where he was going to remove 1/2 of the Turks in the country. But then it says they wanted to do that, but then they were afraid of the Turks. And no, they were afraid of being overrun by the Turks. Well, he didn't, you know, he washed around, I guess. And then things change, and they say, well, eventually the next generation was better than the first generation, and the Germans were getting used to them. I don't know if that's the truth or if they just have time to push that idea across and people accept it. Well,
yeah, Don? I think that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that's another indication of how weak our enemies' arguments are, and that their big justification for mass third world immigration is unemployed or filling jobs that are going unfilled in our own countries. And yet you go to anywhere in Western Europe and there's just thousands, if not millions, of these black and brown immigrants on welfare, not contributing anything. And you have all these millions on welfare and the governments are still telling their people, oh, we need more people. We need more immigrants or our economy is going to collapse. And it's just such a transparent lie. And yet because no real debate's allowed in the media, they're allowed to get away with such poor arguments.
Yeah, well, I just thought, I'm looking here on my email and, I've got one that might be somebody. Oh, says scroll down. I see women. Oh, well, one of my correspondents, and he also just sent a donation. Isn't that nice of him? He linked to the Greek Golden Dawn website the one in the United States, the English language one, and said scroll down, and he sees a lot of women there. So, yeah, I've always seen women amongst the Golden Dawn. And that is, well, would you like to say something about the Golden Dawn in a little bit of time we have left?
Sure. I guess just to promote the Daily Stormer and what Andrew England is doing for our cause. For months now, people have talked about how important the Golden Dawn is, how impressive it is, how this is the model we need to follow. But that England is the only one who's actually gotten up and gone over to Greece to actually study them, at least as far as I know. So I think that shows a great deal of initiative and leadership on his part to actually go and try to learn from them as much as possible. And he's already talked a little bit on the Daily Stormer and on your show about his observations there. And I'm looking forward to the continued success of the Golden Dawn and also what we're able to learn from them and what England will be able to tell us about them in the coming months as he spends more time over there.
Well, right. Well, how do you feel about the Golden Dawn being the answer that, you know, so many people are focused on that as, oh, boy, you know, they're hoping that they will take over the political leaders, they actually take over the power in the country, which would not be done without a lot of penalties given to them by all the other European nations and many and United States, too, and so on. They would be really on their own, even if they could accomplish this, if the Greek people, enough of them, would feel that they had some advantage in actually voting them in. Even that, how do you see that? Do you think that we should be putting? I altogether agree with what Andre is doing over there. It's great that he's over there. Plus, he's getting a lot of education and a lot of experience in a lot of things. Do you think that people are overly focused there and thinking that there's going to be some kind of miracle coming from this, and it just can't really happen that way?
Well, I certainly agree with you that Greece turning nationalist on its own would have a very tough time of it. I think if you look back to what the United States did to Serbia in the 90s when they were trying to create basically a nationalist state in a lot of ways, and you had General Leslie Clark, who was heavily involved with that campaign against Serbia. I think he may have led it, I don't remember exactly, but he said explicitly there's no room in Europe today for a mono-ethnic state. And so that was one of the justifications given for invading Serbia, for bombing them back in the 90s.
Right.
So I think,
that's flat out. There's no, we do not accept a mono-ethnic state. Wow.
So I think for sure NATO could justify some sort of attack on Greece if they completely took over. I think that's something that NATO would want to do very quickly, just because, you know, once again, going back to the Third Reich, it would have been so dangerous for the communists and Jewish capitalists in England and the United States and the Soviet Union to just allow Germany to flourish, because everyone would see what a successful model this is and how happy the people are. And it would lead more people to accept the nationalist position I think the same thing would happen in Greece, where there's so many people throughout Europe suffering because of this immigration. If they saw a country just swiftly and effectively deal with the problem, they would certainly want to try to enact the same thing in their own countries. As far as focusing on the Golden Dawn, I think it could certainly be very, very fruitful to see why they're successful, how do they organize, why is it that they are the most successful genuine nationalist party that we've seen in Europe for decades, and try to learn from them. If Golden Dawn and Greece is to be to the start of a nationalist movement, it would have to spread to other countries rather rapidly, but I think that certainly is a possibility and definitely the most positive development that we've seen for a long time.
I think, too, that it is that, say, 60 seconds we've got now. I think also that it, now I threw myself off by looking at the time here. That they are uncompromising. I think that's the best thing about them, for me, that they are, and they are the most successful because they're the most uncompromising, or the two things are going together for them. So, this idea about compromising too much is not good. So I think your plan for the Daily Stormer is real good, although you want to keep it uncompromising, but not overly offensive, you know, as you were saying earlier, right?
Yeah, well, not okay. Inoffensive, but I know we're running out of time, but yes, we're definitely going to keep it uncompromising and try to learn from the Golden Dawn.
I'm going to have to say goodbye, Clement. Sorry, the music is playing. And so thanks, everybody, for listening. And I sure think you're really one great person. I look forward to it.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.